Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, work with one that has your best interests in mind. Use Rocket Mortgage for a transparent, trustworthy home loan process that's completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The Trump presidency is still a week away, but yesterday the country got another glimpse of what it will probably look and sound like. There was the president-elect's press conference in Trump Tower in New York. It got fiery. And there was Rex Tillerson, the former ExxonMobil CEO, in a Senate confirmation hearing on his nomination to be the nation's next top diplomat. Unflappable, not always on the same page as the boss. This hour, On Point, the next president and maybe the next Secretary of State speak to the press, the Senate, and the American people. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What did you make of Donald Trump's press conference? Was it reassuring, unnerving, informative? And what did you make of Rex Tillerson's performance on Capitol Hill? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Major Garrett, chief White House correspondent for CBS News. He was at the president-elect's press conference in New York, even got a few questions in. Major Garrett, always great to have you here.
Hello, Tom.
Also in Washington, Matt Visor, deputy Washington bureau chief for the Boston Globe. Matt, great to have you back.
Hey, thanks, Tom.
And Michael Crowley joins us, also in Washington, senior foreign affairs correspondent for Political. Michael Crowley, welcome.
Thank you, Tom. Good to be here.
Major Garrett, you were there. You've seen plenty of White House press conferences in the White House. Here we were in Trump Tower. How was it like and unlike the typical, the usual?
Well, let's just talk about the transition press conferences I had attended previously. George W. Bush and Barack Obama, they were done typically in transition offices, much more stately affairs, trying to create the aura of the presidency to be. And they were much more frequent. In both transitions, I covered George W. Bush and Barack Obama. By this time in the transition, we would have had two or three, maybe more, press conferences as cabinet secretary designees had been rolled out and the president-elect was sort of warming up for the presidency itself. And an engagement with reporters and the American public after the election was something they wanted to get started and bring themselves and the country together in a conversation. President-elect Trump waited as long as possible before having his first press conference as president-elect. That it was in Trump Tower is not unusual to me. I've been a party to many of the press conferences at Trump Tower. That's an unusual place to hold a press conference. It's cramped, very cramped, especially when President-elect Trump is involved. The acoustics are bad. The sight lines aren't very good. But it's his place. It's his turf. And if you want to understand something about President-elect Trump, turf is very important to him. People coming to his turf, talking to him on his terms, where he wants to be, and where he projects not only his personality, what he believes is his clout. And that was a big part of the location for this press conference yesterday.
Matt, we heard applause there. Who was the applause
Trump
from?
Trump employees. Trump employees. Part of the peanut gallery that travels with Trump everywhere he goes. Not just employees, but because it was at Trump Tower, employees were there. And there were some, I guess, I don't know if other supporters or friends were invited. I was far too consumed with the preparation for that press conference to do an interview of everyone who was there. But I do know those who were applauding were Trump employees.
The first questions came on this dossier that's been compiled, funded by opponents of Donald Trump. First Republicans, we read, during the primary, and then picked up by that funding by Democrats later. And his response was very fiery on that. You know, the reporting on it has been so kind of patchy and obscure that a lot of people might not even know what he was talking about. He went after BuzzFeed. He went after CNN. What's been reported, Major, that Donald Trump was being asked about and responding to?
Well, you're right, Tom. The reporting has been, to use your terminology, patchy for a very good reason. This dossier, and I think that's even a term that gives it too much glamour and credibility, perhaps. A collection of raw intelligence from a lot of different sources, utterly unnamed and unverified to a large extent, about things that might be embarrassing to President-elect Trump, then-candidate Trump, as far as his business dealings or potential business dealings in Russia and some of his personal conduct there. Some of it's salacious, again, unsubstantiated. We at CBS have never talked about it. We haven't reported it. We certainly didn't put anything online that is relevant to this so-called dossier. But it was condensed in a two-page form by the U.S. intelligence community and appended, meaning sort of stapled to the larger documentation presented to President-elect Trump last week, dealing with the intelligence community's assessment, consensus assessment, about the motivations of Russian hacking during the 2016 elections, what it did, what it was meant to do, and that it was disruptive to the underlying democratic process, all at the direction of Russian President Vladimir Putin. So the president-elect responded to all of that and tried to blame the U.S. intelligence community either for producing this document, which it did not, leaking it, which James Clapper, the head of the Director of National Intelligence, called Trump last night to say it didn't, but leaks are bad. They can agree on that, but they don't agree on much else. And there is what I think is the most important takeaway from this. During the entire Trump transition, a very fraught relationship between this incoming administration and the existing intelligence community. And until there is a better and more seamless meeting of the minds between these two entities, they're not yet adversaries, but they're looking at each other as they might be adversaries, we're in for a rough ride.
Here was Donald Trump yesterday at the news conference, press conference, which alleges compromising, salacious information about him unverified. He went after the news media there. Here's how he responded.
I saw the information. I read the information outside of that meeting. It's all fake news. It's phony stuff. It didn't happen. And it was gotten by opponents of ours, as you know, because you reported it, and so did many of the other people. It was a group of opponents that got together, sick people, and they put that crap together.
Michael Crowley, your foreign affairs correspondent for Politico. This puts the American people in a pretty weird situation. I mean, we're hearing headlines on the news all over the place that there's, I mean, I'm hearing lurid, salacious, sexual encounters in Moscow, things that could subject the next president of the United States to blackmail by the Kremlin. And yet we know in the press we're reading almost nothing. This is an odd situation for everybody, Michael.
It is an odd situation, Tom, and it's also, you know, the latest manifestation of the strangeness of the kind of media environment we live in, the transparency, the virality of information. I mean, intelligence agencies and people who compile this kind of opposition research have always known that things can leak out into the press, but there are now so many more avenues. A dossier like this, you know, once would have been stapled together on paper and would be passed around, maybe Xeroxed or something. Now, it, you know, instantaneously the file is emailed from one person to another, and BuzzFeed can upload it in the snap of their finger. Really, they may have spent a very long time considering the decision. I don't know, but they
the
may
full
have
35-page or 35 pages anyway of a dossier. The intelligence community here put together a 2-page summary of that, I guess, that was presented to Donald Trump and many others. Now, you know, it bounces all over the cyberspace.
Now it bounces all over cyberspace for the world to see. And just to quickly make sure listeners understand, I think Major explained this, the original dossier is not an intelligence community document. It was done essentially by opposition researchers who hired a former intelligence agent acting privately.
From MI5 in Britain.
That's
just
right.
For steal, yeah.
That's right. Currently on the run, trying to escape the world's attention, which is on him and in a very uncomfortable position, as are, I would assume, his sources. In any event, it's a very tricky position for the public to be in because, first of all, people aren't really – they don't have context. So, you know, generally speaking, your average American, even a lot of journalists, don't really know how – seriously to take the work of someone like this. You know, who are these kinds of people, former intelligence agents who are selling their services to private opposition research firms, for instance? Do they have an incentive to pump up what they're finding to please their bosses so that the contract gets renewed and they're sent out to go back and get more? Do they have an incentive to pump up their findings so that they can wave their product around and get another client? I think that's a big question here. On the other hand, there have been many reports that say that U.S. intelligence officials take this particular guy very seriously. They think he's a credible guy. And although this is getting speculative, you know, there's been a line of commentary which I think makes sense to the effect that this would not have been summarized and included in a report to Trump if intelligence officials thought it didn't even pass the laugh test and it was totally absurd. I mean,
he went so hard at the press. He went hard at BuzzFeed who put the document out. He went hard at CNN. What did CNN report that had the president so upset, Michael?
Well, so the Trump camp seems to be
trying
to conflate what BuzzFeed did with what CNN did. CNN did what I thought was a pretty very responsible multi-bylined article that was clearly the product of a lot of research and reporting that essentially said what Major described. It broke the news that when Trump had this briefing on Friday that everybody knows about, the fact that he had it was public, about Russian efforts to influence the U.S. election. And actually, the briefing took a wider view of Russian cyber activities and influence activities going back several years. There was an appendix to the document that he was given. I confess, Tom, I'm a little unclear because there have been conflicting reports whether there was a verbal explanation of this or not. I believe the Trump camp says there was not. But in any event, in some form or other, the intelligence officials had this two-page summary, which has been described as having been given to him as a way of saying, here's, there are sort of alternate explanations, but
you should know what's out there.
You should know what's out there. Here's a heads up. It's probably coming out anyway. We're not giving this to you because we think it's true and we're trying to put you on the spot. It's kind of a heads up.
Michael Crowley, hold the thought. Yeah, I want to get to Matt Visor for just a moment. Matt, we're going to get to the substance of the press conference, more of it. But what did the form here tell you about what the relationship between this president, when he takes office, and the press, and through that, in a way, the American people, is going to be like, Matt?
Absolutely adversarial. Trump had this odd moment. Or first of all, it started off with Sean Spicer, the incoming press secretary and communications director for Donald Trump, sort of giving a tongue-lashing, really, to the press for its behavior in reporting some of the Russian allegations, and really sort of lumping in the BuzzFeed decision with the CNN decision.
So Trump was very complimentary when he took the microphone, saying a lot of people showed a lot of restraint on this unverified material.
He was, up until the moment when CNN's Jim Acosta tried to ask a question, and Trump sort of called CNN fake news. It was very antagonistic, very argumentative, not letting Jim Acosta ask a question. In fact, Acosta later reported that he was told if he continued trying to ask questions, he would be thrown out.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the president-elect's press conference yesterday. We'll look later at Rex Tillerson before the Senate. Michael Crowley is with us from Politico. Major Garrett is here, chief White House correspondent for CBS News. Matt Visor, deputy Washington bureau chief for the Boston Globe. You can join us. What tone is the president-elect setting for his interactions with the media, with the American public? Is it good? The right tone? The wrong tone? Are we going to be well informed about the workings, the views of this administration? Do you want to know, need to know, the details in that dossier out of Russia, the lurid, salacious sexual stuff and more, or not? BuzzFeed put out the full document, if you will, and Trump jumped right on them, and CIA, who had done reporting around it as well. Here he was in his first news conference in a long, long time yesterday.
As far as BuzzFeed, which is a failing pile of garbage, writing it, I think they're going to suffer the consequences. They already are. And as far as CNN going out of their way to build it up, and by the way, we just found out, I was coming down, Michael Cohen is a very talented lawyer.
And it went on. Michael Cohen, who has worked with Donald Trump, was said to have been in one of these meetings of his people with Moscow, alleged, unverified here in Prague. Trump said he never was in Prague. CNN, Jim Acosta tried to ask a question of the president-elect, and it got really wild there. They both stuck to their guns. Here's that protracted exchange, some of it.
Since you're attacking us, can you give us a question? Mr. President-elect.
Go ahead.
Mr. President-elect, since you are attacking our news organization, can you give us a chance?
Your organization.
You are attacking our news organization.
Your organization.
Can you give us a chance to ask a question, sir?
Go ahead.
Sir, can
quiet.
You state, can,
quiet.
Mr. President-elect,
go ahead.
Can you state categorically,
she's asking a question. Don't
Mr. President-elect, can you give us a question?
Don't be rude.
You're attacking us. Can you give us a question?
Don't be rude.
Can you give us a question?
I'm not going to give you a question.
Can you state categorically?
You are fake news.
Sir,
go ahead.
Can you state categorically that nobody. No, Mr. President-elect, that's not appropriate.
Okay, and he never did acknowledge Jim Acosta there. Major Garrett asked him. I mean, there's the press part. We'll look at that. There's the intelligence community and the relationship that will be there. Major Garrett, who's with us today, asked him about the so-called Russian dossier and the contents that came out on BuzzFeed, and about his comparison of that, some of that reporting and its release to what, I guess, by intelligence agencies he was asserting here, to Nazi Germany, Trump said. Let's listen.
The truth tweet that you had this morning about are we living in Nazi Germany, what were you driving at there? What are you trying to tell the
American people? I think it was disgraceful that the intelligence agencies allowed any information that turned out to be so false and fake out. I think it's a disgrace. And I say that. And that's something that Nazi Germany would have done and did do. I think it's a disgrace that information that was false and fake and never happened got released to the public.
Major Garrett, what did you learn yesterday about what's coming in this president-elect's relationship with the intelligence community? And I want to look at what's coming with the press as well. But first, intelligence, Major.
Well, I think it's an open wound right now. And there's a lot to unpack here, and I'll try to condense it as best I can, Tom. Remember when the Trump transition began and the intelligence community began to say, look, there was hacking of the U.S. election. It might have been from the Russians, probably was from the Russians. Their interests were not pure. They were not altruistic. They were trying to put the thumb on the scale. And then it became clear that the consensus was it was to help Hillary Clinton, possibly help Donald Trump, but nevertheless undermine a faith in the American democratic processes. Donald Trump said, why should we believe that? Why should we take any of that seriously? It could have been someone who weighed 400 pounds in a basement on their bed. And besides, the intelligence community are the ones who told us there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. His first response was to politicize the most glaring mistake of the intelligence community of the last 20 years. One, those still in the community and those who were part of it at the time regret
on
and
Iraq.
Often say was a mistake, but so much of, on balance, the intelligence community's work at the time and since has been stellar. And for the president-elect to take that particular attack and line of attack created this very rough atmosphere that now continues. And I've talked to several Republicans who are deeply concerned that the president-elect does not appreciate, A, the work the intelligence community does, B, its relevance to his day-to-day functioning as president of the United States, and C, the intelligence community's continuous ability to make life very difficult for a president who doesn't take its work seriously or denigrates it in public.
But on the other hand, Matt Visor, you've got a president-elect here with unverified reports put out here about cavorting with prostitutes in Moscow, blah, blah, blah. Totally unverified. And he suspects the intelligence community may have put it out. You can see where that would really bug somebody.
Yeah, I mean, and the irony here is for Donald Trump, much of his campaign was built on innuendo, questioning Obama's birth certificate, and sort of people are saying, you know, accusations that didn't necessarily stand up with his, you know, sort of rumors about Ted Cruz or and his father, you know. So Trump spent much of the campaign doing the very thing that is now being done to him. So he's now on the receiving end of it. And it wasn't really right when Trump was doing it. And it's not necessarily right now. There is some criticism to be had for the types of things that Trump is sort of having to try and answer to. I think it is a tough discussion to have. And as Michael was alluding to earlier, just our digital age and sort of the ability of information to get out there when it's unverified and there's not, you know, news organizations have spent weeks and months trying to verify some of the things that are included in this and have been unable to. So that's why I think that the American public has not seen it up until now with BuzzFeed's decision.
Tom, yeah. If I could jump in,
Major.
It's a really important distinction. The intelligence community did not generate this 35 pages.
The two pages together, and that came out also, and he's blaming them for that, though James Clapper says we didn't release this, right? Do I have that right?
Right. That's that is taking something that the intelligence community, if you have a disagreement with them about these two pages, conduct that disagreement in private and say, wait a minute, I'm the consumer of this information. I don't think I need to know this. That's a conversation you can carry out.
But Donald Trump said he tried to have it privately and it should have stayed private, and it did not stay private. That was his complaint yesterday, Major.
Yes, and so the complaint, though, still lodges the problem with the U.S. intelligence community. That the intelligence community decided to brief him on it in good – what it considers to be good practices and good conscience is not proof that it is against him and is trying to undermine him, or as Vice President-elect Mike Pence said, demean the election of the Trump-Pence ticket. And to accuse the intelligence community of that and to compare it to Nazi tactics creates a very public rift and destabilizes a relationship that for the main, for any president and the country at large, ought to be less fraught with either misunderstandings or public disagreement.
Well, he sure seemed to take it as demeaning yesterday. There was news. I mean, for the first time, I think ever, he acknowledged that he thought it was Russia that did the hacking, not some 400-pound guy in bed somewhere.
As far as hacking, I think it was Russia. But I think we also get hacked by other countries and other people.
But he sort of backtracked on that at one point. And also, even if it was Russia, he said, we ought to have a good relationship. It's good if Putin prefers Donald Trump. It's good if he likes him anyway. Here was the president-elect.
If Putin likes Donald Trump, I consider that an asset, not a liability, because we have a horrible relationship with Russia. Russia can help us fight ISIS, which, by the way, is number one tricky. I mean, if you look, this administration created ISIS by leaving at the wrong time. The void was created. ISIS was formed. If Putin likes Donald Trump, guess what, folks? That's called an asset, not a liability.
Michael Crowley, we're going to look at Rex Tillerson in a few minutes here and his testimony on Capitol Hill yesterday. But where does this leave the American public's understanding of the relationship between Donald Trump and Russia, his view of that relationship? And should people just put out of their mind the possibility of blackmail because it's not verified? Should just forget about it? Don't worry about it? Or not?
Well, Tom, we we live in crazy times. I'm not going to tell people to put something out of their mind entirely. It's a low probability scenario for sure. But I think let's step back for a second. The way Donald Trump has talked about Vladimir Putin and Russia for more than a year now, in fact, for longer, is very unusual. And at times I find it to be very strange. Time and time again, when Trump is presented with evidence of Putin's wrongdoing, malfeasance, aggression, in cases where there is a broad, at least Western consensus that Putin has done bad things. To take one example, the murder of Alexander Litvinenko in London, who drank polonium from a teacup, mm-hmm. the killing of journalists in Russia, the shoot down of the MH17 passenger jet over Ukraine, apparently with a Russian-provided missile given to the Russian-backed separatists in Ukraine. All those cases, when there's a lot of evidence tracing it to Putin's doorstep, at a minimum that he condoned, for instance, these killings. We don't know if he actually ordered them. Trump waves it off and says, you don't know that. People say it. I hear one thing and I hear another thing. Who knows? On and on it goes. I find it extremely strange. So I think it's reasonable to say, why is he doing this? He has never articulated much of a strategic rationale beyond cooperating in the fight against ISIS, which is not a ridiculous point, but there's not much more to it than that. And there also does seem to be a kind of personal affinity for Putin. Just a few days ago when Putin, after Obama imposed new sanctions on Russia, Putin, you know, kind of held his tongue, didn't fire back, and Trump yep. tweeted that it was very smart of Putin. It's very strange. And the last thing I'll say, Tom, is it doesn't necessarily have to be some exotic blackmail. In Russia, they call it kompromat situation.
Compromising material. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Videotape in a hotel room. I think if Trump would release his tax returns, it would put a lot of the conspiracy theorizing to rest, because a lot of the more plausible explanations, if we think there could be some undisclosed reason for all this, have to do with his financial entanglements. Does he have debt to Russian banks? Does he have investments he is not telling us about? He says he doesn't. But Tom, that's where I would focus, you know, my thinking, journalistic inquiries.
Here he was yesterday on that front, the tax returns, and whether he's going to or should or needs to release them.
You know, the only one that cares about my tax returns are the reporters. Okay, they're the only ones. But no, I don't think so. I won. I mean, I became president.
Terry in Dover, Delaware. Terry, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I noticed that the hotel thing is taking up all the oxygen in the room, but Trump doing disgusting things with women is just another, you know, dog bites man story.
Well, we don't know. That's all. This is unverified. Yeah, but what's your question or commentary?
True or not. My question is that they need to, as soon as possible, investigate his ties to Russia, taking off what the last caller said. you know, there are rumors that he is in debt to people who are connected with Putin and with the Russian mob to the tune of $500 million.
Well,
everything he has done in his foreign policy so far, such as demanding that the entire ambassadorial corps come home by Inauguration Day, will leave the entire State Department sidelined. The Russians can do whatever they want, and there will be no ambassadors to deal with this on a, you know, on the sort of basis that the State Department would.
Terry, we've got Major Garrett. Are we back in the realm of rumors there? The president-elect said yesterday that he had no debt and no business dealings with Russia, period? It was pretty black and white what he said.
That's what he said. And to Michael's point, one of the ways to verify that is to release tax returns. And look, President-elect Trump tried something enormously audacious in the campaign, many things that were audacious in the campaign. One of the most audacious was to say, you know what? I don't have to release my tax returns. I can give you this cover story that they're under audit. There is no reason while something is under audit that it cannot be released. And every other presidential candidate has done so for the better part of 40 years. And he said, you know what? I won, so I don't need to. And that political reality no longer exists. I've shattered that on my behalf. And until he is forced politically to do and think otherwise, I guarantee you he's going to stick there, which is going to leave these questions, as Michael accurately pointed out, not only unresolved, but unresolvable.
There was a big stack of manila envelopes on a table next to the podium yesterday where he said there were signed documents about how he had extracted himself from his business interests. Here he was on that ethics and conflict of interest front yesterday.
My two sons, who are right here, Don and Eric, are going to be running the company. They are going to be running it in a very professional manner. They're not going to discuss it with me.
Ivanka Trump was there too, Matt Visor. Was this a satisfactory extraction from conflict of interest questions?
Not altogether, no. The Office of Ethics, the head of that later sort of ridiculed the plan and sort of said that this was absolutely not satisfactory, that there is no... the trust and the blind trust, it doesn't hold up, and it's actually not a blind trust. But Trump is trying to separate himself in some way, but he still owns the company. His sons will be running it. There's still a lot of room for concern here, and so the press conference did not in any way sort of alleviate some of those concerns. Going back just real quickly on the taxes thing, Trump also was claiming that people don't care about this, which is factually untrue. There was a Pew survey January 10th that said 2/3 of Americans think that this is important, his taxes.
But only 38% of Republicans, I note, said the same. Right. In that, it's interesting. It's Justine in Atlanta, Georgia. Justine, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I am a Trump supporter, and I listened to the press conference yesterday in its entirety on NPR.
Yeah.
And I have to say that I was a little bit disappointed with his performance, which is exactly what it seemed like. It seemed like a performance. It didn't seem like he really had any interest in actually answering any of the questions. Anything that he was asked, he sort of went back to... our trade policies with Mexico, they're terrible. They're the worst trade policies ever.
What does that leave you thinking, Justine, as a supporter?
I still want to give him the benefit of the doubt. I am confident with the people that he's nominated to his cabinet so far, if people can actually get confirmed. But I am a little bit worried that he's had, you know, a month, 6 weeks, however long it's been since the election, that he's actually been working on his policy proposals to iron out these details, and he doesn't seem to be able to articulate them still.
Justine's
so
still waiting.
That the people that he's appointed to his cabinet, yep, do a little better job of that.
Justine's still waiting in Atlanta, and a Trump supporter there. Major Garrett, what's it leave you thinking about you cover the White House, about the years ahead and this president and the press?
Well, look, every American president and every press corps that covers them has a job to do. And our job is to be done independent of whatever the atmospherics are that any president creates, hostile, complimentary, or cooperative, or whatever. And Jim Acosta did exactly what any reporter is supposed to do, keep battling away to get a question in there and not worry about the underlying consequences. Be truthful, be accurate, be aggressive, and let the chips fall where they may on a day-to-day, hour-to-hour basis. It's hard work, but that's what we do.
Boy, it's going to be interesting. Major Garrett is chief White House correspondent for CBS News. Major, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
Michael Crowley at Politico, Matt Visor at the Boston Globe. Please stand by. We're going to look at Rex Tillerson in Senate hearings yesterday to be Secretary of State. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, work with one that has your best interests in mind. Rocket Mortgage provides a transparent online process that helps you understand all the details of your home loan. You can even adjust the rate and length of your loan in real time to make sure you get the right mortgage solution for you. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We've been looking at Donald Trump's first news conference in a long time yesterday, about 6 months, as he prepares for inauguration next week. I want to look right now at the Senate hearings on Donald Trump's nominee to be Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson. He was on Capitol Hill yesterday and got a pretty substantial interaction there with the Senate looking at his views on the world. You can join us this hour. What did you hear in that testimony from the former CEO of ExxonMobil, Rex Tillerson, now nominated to be Secretary of State? Does he look like a good next U.S. Secretary of State to you? Will he be tough enough on Russia, on climate change? Do you trust him to put American national interests ahead of everything else? The former oil company CEO there. Michael Crowley is with us, senior foreign affairs correspondent for Politico. Matt Visor is here, deputy Washington bureau chief for the Boston Globe. Tillerson said that American global prestige had declined in the Obama years, he told the senators. He said the next president's going to be dealt a tough hand of cards by what they're inheriting here. But he said it's time to repair the damage.
There's no use in whining about it. There's no use in complaining or pointing fingers at anyone. We're just going to play that hand out, because what I know is America still holds all the aces. We just need to draw them out of that deck. And that leaders around the world want our engagement. I said, you're going to be pushing on an open door, because people want America to come back.
You've got a Texan talking right there, and you can hear that loud and clear. Michael Crowley, a lot of headlines say rocky hearings. I didn't catch all of it, but he looked pretty unflappable, I would say, before the senators. What did you see and hear, Michael?
Yeah, I thought strictly as a matter of his performance, did he seem articulate? Did he seem confident, poised? Did he have a good grasp of the issues? He did. There was a glitch where he made an error describing the Iran nuclear deal, but it was, I think, a relatively minor one. I mean, this is a guy who did not seem to be in over his head, and to the degree that the Secretary of State is a kind of spokesman for the country and obviously the top diplomat, you know, I think he passed that test pretty well. I think a lot of the attention focused on some very aggressive questioning from Florida Senator Marco Rubio, who is a key vote on the committee because he's a Republican. The Republicans have a one-vote majority on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And if Rubio opposes Tillerson, then Tillerson will not be voted out with a positive recommendation. Now, his nomination can still go to the Senate floor with a vote of disapproval, but it kind of taints it and it makes it easier for senators to oppose him in a larger confirmation vote. So Rubio is important, and Rubio really grilled him.
On what front, Michael? On what fronts?
Well, Tom, it was interesting. I mean, I would say the most notably on sort of human rights and morality in American foreign policy. And I thought it was a fascinating little look at two very different views of foreign policy philosophies that are sort of dividing the Republican Party right now. And Rubio is basically what I would call a neocon. And what I mean when I say that, a neoconservative, he believes that American foreign policy should be strongly shaped by morality, by values, promoting democracy and human rights, caring a lot about the nature of regimes that we deal with, and having less dealings with other countries if we think that their leadership is nasty, is thuggish, is killing people.
This is Rubio. What about Tillerson?
This is Rubio. Tillerson had what I saw as much more of a realist view, which essentially says you can't get too hung up on what's happening inside other countries' borders. We have to do business with the important partners around the world to achieve our strategic objectives. And I'm not going to get pushed into corners the way Rubio was trying to say Vladimir Putin is a war criminal because of Russian bombing. bombing in Syria to denounce the Saudis for the limits on women's rights in that country. And, you know, this is consistent with the CEO of ExxonMobil. He is a businessman. He's transactional. And I think that, you know, that's where he's coming from. And so I think there was a lot of attention given to that exchange. He might lose Rubio and it would be problematic, but I don't think it's going to cause Tillerson to change his worldview.
Here was a little of that exchange. Senator Marco Rubio of Florida grilling the Secretary of State nominee about whether or not there had been war crimes, Russian war crimes in Syria, Aleppo.
You are still not prepared to say that Vladimir Putin and his military have violated the rules of war and have conducted war crimes in Aleppo.
Now, those are very, very serious charges to make, and I would want to have much more information before reaching a conclusion.
So he wasn't ready to go there. On the other hand, he seemed to part ways somewhat with the Trump line on Russia when he agreed with senators about the dangers Russia poses now to the U.S.
We must also be clear-eyed about our relationship with Russia. Russia today poses a danger, but it is not unpredictable in advancing its own interest. It has invaded the Ukraine, including the taking of Crimea, and supported Syrian forces that brutally violates the laws of war. Our NATO allies are right to be alarmed at a resurgent Russia.
Matt Visor, how significant a gap is that between the Tillerson view and the Trump view, as far as we can make out?
Well, one of the striking things that happened during the hearing was, Tillerson and Trump do not have a long history together. Tillerson sort of came on Trump's radar only in December, they don't have a long relationship. And several times Tillerson sort of conceded that he hadn't talked with Trump about some issues, including the Russian actions in Aleppo, sort of how Trump felt about Russia. Under questioning from Bob Menendez, the senator from New Jersey, Tillerson said that hasn't happened yet, which Menendez sort of rightly said that's pretty amazing. There were a lot of instances where Tillerson was breaking with Trump on the ban on Muslims, for example, the climate deal in Paris, a deal that Trump has vowed to cancel. That agreement or the U.S. participation in it. So Tillerson seemed much more open to continuing in that climate agreement. As you heard, Tillerson taking a much more stronger line than Trump has on Russia and criticizing Russia for invading Ukraine. So you do get the sense of a difference of opinions. Obviously, the president's opinion matters more than the Secretary of State's opinion, in handing out U.S. foreign policy. Mm. So I think that Trump's opinion on a lot of these matters sort of matter more than Tillerson's. But there was a lot of evidence of Tillerson breaking with Trump or not knowing what Trump thinks on certain issues.
Depending how much the president, when he takes office, delegates. There's a lot of talk about delegating here, but we'll see. Those issues are pretty key to his campaign. Lori in Montgomery, Alabama. Thank you for calling, Lori. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
One thing about Rex Tillerson that I appreciated was that I felt like he actually was intelligent compared to when I listened to Donald Trump. I feel like he speaks like a third grader, where Tillerson actually sounds like an adult. The only thing about him that I felt like his inability to call Putin a war criminal just shows the extent of his financial ties to Russia, and I felt like he didn't seem to know anything about the world except for what he wanted to know about Russia.
Lori, I appreciate your call. Michael Crowley, fair or not? I mean, the assertion is that ExxonMobil under Rex Tillerson lobbied hard against U.S. sanctions against Russia over Ukraine. I think there was some denial of that yesterday, but he sure visited the White House a lot of times. But Lori's saying, well, compromising financial ties, is that fair at this point? What about the hangover of ExxonMobil history?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a concern. I want to briefly say that I've seen some shots at Tillerson from the left over his exchange with Rubio and his refusal to brand Russian actions in Syria and also in Chechnya going back more than a decade as war crimes. In fact, the Obama administration has not used that phrase itself. So that's a complicated subject. You know, a lot of times you can't say what you really think in diplomacy. So, but
maybe that's just sober diplomacy there.
I think it's sober diplomacy. You know, you do have to deal with these countries when you brand, when you say war crimes. I think it may trigger, you know, legal obligations you have to pursue. So complicated subject, not time to go much further.
But it does feed into this concern about human rights in general that Rubio and others raised, and how much Tillerson cares.
Well, having said that, right, so, you know, I explained before that I see Tillerson as a realist, as a kind of mercantilist who is not going to get too hung up on morality and foreign policy. But, you know, Barack Obama came in with some pretty lofty rhetoric about, you know, lifting people up and human rights and democracy. And a lot of that went down the drain, particularly after the Arab Spring. Again, that's a very complicated subject. But Barack Obama, you know, was not one of the great champions of democracy and human rights, decided that we had other priorities. So this is very complicated stuff. You know, on the financial entanglements, I don't know that look, Rex Tillerson is an oil man who probably sees the world, again, in a very transactional way. I don't know about, like, hidden financial ties to Russia. Mm. There's a lot that's out there in the open. He's done a lot of business with the Russians. And he's, in, you know, in the context of sanctions, for instance, he's thinking about how is American foreign policy affecting big business. Now, he says he's going to put the national interest first, and so people can decide whether to take his word at that. But he definitely comes with that muscle memory, and I think that would be the concern.
Sarah in Glenmore, Pennsylvania. Sarah, you're on the air.
Hi. I just want to say I don't really feel that Rex Tillerson is being honest about his true feelings toward Russia. I think he's saying what he has to say to get through the confirmation. It's pretty well documented, his long history and relationship with Russia and Putin, and that's my opinion.
But he had to have a relationship if he was looking to drill for oil in the Russian Arctic, I guess, as CEO of ExxonMobil, but he's not CEO anymore, so...
Yeah, but I don't think that you can be CEO of a company for that many years and totally just drop it, you know, at the drop of a hat. Not only that, but, you know, the question about the lobbying, and when he denied the lobbying... you know, the whole thing about the farce about climate change and the fact that his company denied climate change.
Though he didn't, you know, yesterday. Sarah, I appreciate your call very much. I'll come to climate change. I wanted to ask also, though, about, and thank you, Sarah, I wanted to ask about the question from Tim Kaine, who, of course, was Hillary Clinton's running mate, Virginia Democrat. He pushed Tillerson on speculation about financial ties between the Trump Organization and Russian officials or officials in other countries. Here was Tillerson's, again, very circumspect response.
I have no knowledge.
And if I asked you the same question and I substituted Turkey, China, Pakistan, or Japan for Russia in that question, would your answer be the same?
I have no knowledge.
So I gather from your answer that you'll then have no way of knowing how actions proposed by a President Trump regarding those countries or others would affect his personal or family financial interests.
I have no knowledge.
Matt Visor, this is a man who's used accustomed to power, and he's not going to be budged right there.
Yeah, and I mean that gets to the core of some of these questions of you know, the Tillerson Trump relationship, and sort of what you can discern about motivations for each of these guys. And to Sarah's point about sort of Tillerson's own history with Exxon and with Russia, those are the questions that are going to, you know, sort of either lead him to be confirmed or doom his candidacy. I mean, John McCain and Lindsey Graham both need to be convinced. Marco Rubio was certainly skeptical yesterday as well. So, I mean, I think there's still open questions about him and Russia, you know, and sort of his ties there. And whether him as a businessman is different than him as a diplomat, you know, and I think that he's trying to answer those questions. But, you know, it's still open question sort of whether he's convinced people.
Michael Crowley, if there are different perspectives between Rex Tillerson and Donald Trump on the world, how's that get resolved? Is he just, you know, if he's approved, does he move into the State Department and take up the Trump line, or what do you anticipate?
Tom, I don't know how to answer that question, to be perfectly honest. I don't know what to anticipate. I mean, we are really driving without a map right now, and I suspect that even some of the people going into the administration, I don't want to speak for Rex Tillerson or anyone specifically, but I would guess that some of the people going into the administration doing it a little bit on a wing and a prayer. They can't be sure what to expect, because Trump is all over the place on a lot of these issues. And it doesn't, you know, as Matt said, sound from Tillerson's remarks yesterday like Tillerson went through a long checklist of Trump specific policy questions and got clarity. To some degree, you know, it's possible that a guy like Tillerson is going in to be a steady hand on the wheel, understanding that Trump is not experienced, understanding that Trump may himself not fully know what he wants. Remember, Tillerson was strongly promoted by some real, you know, national security establishment veterans like former Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, former National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice, former Bush National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley. By the way, they have worked for Exxon in a consulting capacity, I should note. But, you know, someone like him might be going in thinking he can provide some sobriety and experience around the world. But, Tom, if I told you I knew how this was going to work out, I would be lying.
And what about on the climate change front? I mean, we heard him say we should be at the table. But then he went on to say, to emphasize not so much about the climate, but about U.S. competitiveness. That sounds very Trumpish.
Yeah, absolutely. And I, again, think that he is going to come to this job with a very with a strong business perspective, obviously. I mean, he's spent decades working at a multinational oil corporation that does business all over the world, that's looking for ways to maximize its profits. And he's obviously going to bring that muscle memory to the job. He's kind of under his leadership, ExxonMobil sort of moved around a little bit on global warming. It seemed to me to be blowing in the political winds a little bit. But I think that and Trump is probably given him orders to put American economic power high on his list, because that's something Trump cares a lot about. And I think Trump cares a lot less about recent priorities at the State Department, like promoting women's rights, promoting democracy and human rights and climate. So I would expect that.
Matt, is there a general expectation now in Washington that this nomination goes through, or not clear?
I think that it probably goes through, seems to be the collective reasoning. But, there's still room for lots of questions. Rubio left himself potential outs, but he was quite forceful. And so if he's going to maintain that forcefulness, I think it leaves open some questions whether Tillerson has a bumpier road toward confirmation.
Are you expecting Secretary Tillerson, Michael Crowley?
I think it feels like yes, but I think it's still possible we won't get it. It's a hard call right now. I would lean yes, but I would ask you not to hold me to it.
And if it bumps, it would bump on the Russia question or the human rights question?
I think probably Russia primarily, but Rubio seems very motivated by human rights. A little hard to isolate that, Tom.
Yep. Michael Crowley, senior foreign affairs correspondent for Politico. Thank you so much for being here, Michael.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Matt Visor, Deputy Washington Bureau Chief of the Boston Globe. Many thanks, Matt.
Thanks so much, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.